Hey, great to see you again, Michael.
This has been a long time.
Yeah, it's been a couple years.
Introduce yourself for the people who don't remember you.
Okay. So I'm Michael Fortin. I'm a developer in the Core Operating System Division, focusing on areas of importance, I think, to our customers: reliability, performance, application compatibility, diagnostics, and a system that we call feedback, which is really kind of getting information from all the machines that are running beta and RC, sending back to us, our then processing of that, and making it available to the developers, both inside Microsoft, but also our partners in the ecosystem, whether they're OEMs, ISVs, IHVs, et cetera, and making sure that we work on the right things.
Excellent. Now, of course, you had this telemetry system in Vista as well.
Yes, we did. And actually, some of that actually predated Vista, and but it's been evolving over the years. Yeah. So the system has grown, it's matured. There are many more servers in place now than before. Our data processing capabilities are at new heights. And we're very grateful to the large population of beta and RC users that have sent us information about, A, what they're doing with their machines and where they're having problems, whether it's a crash or a hang or a performance hiccup. A lot of that is funneled back to us, and we've been able to use that to determine what to work on. So we've been very effective, essentially, at using this feedback loop to improve the product over time.
Excellent. I mean, one of the things that's clear about Windows 7 is just efficient from all levels of the system, down from fault-tolerant heat up to things that you experience in you know, user world, say, troubleshooting diagnostics and other things.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because I think it's pretty much, if I had to sum it up in one word.
So efficiency.
Yeah.
So start with efficiency. So we did take a step back and look at all the key paths in the operating system this release, looking at it from a perspective of, okay, people are using our platform in many ways that are similar to the way they used them in the past, but in new ways too. There are different applications, there's different experiences that people are doing with different frequency. And so looking at all the cold paths with a new eye on efficiency, and then targeting work towards those code paths that are used the most and are actually interacting or interfering with the user the most was a big effort. So if you think about the changing nature of the PC, we've got high-end servers, of course. We've got virtual machines, and there's different workloads that are run there than on, say, a netbook-class machine or a low-end, low-power mobile system. And the processing capabilities are very different across that spectrum. So we looked at our code paths, we looked at all the DLLs that we load, we looked at all the processes that we start, we looked at all of our services, we looked at the path to the disk, the path to the network, the path to the screen, and we focused very heavily on seeing if we couldn't reduce the memory used, looking to reduce the cycles on each one of those paths. And of course, most importantly, as we go into the multi-core and many-core area, we looked at what are we doing underneath our locks, which locks do we have, and which locks can we actually get rid of over time, and focused heavily on that. So the system is obviously Vista plus Windows Server 2008 editions, and those things we've been building on. So we had a good platform from many respects, but we had a lot of areas to work on too. And 7, we've had the time, the energy, the effort, and the focus to really go after core efficiency.
Excellent.
So that's the thing that makes me most proud about Windows 7 relative to our past efforts. Uh-huh. It was a large global effort. Pretty much every engineer in Microsoft who owns code was looking at it from a perspective of efficiency this time. And that has been very, very, very helpful.
Absolutely. And clearly it's manifested itself.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what everyone's saying. It's what everyone is experiencing. So right on.
Yeah.
Now, back in the day of Vista, when we first met you and we talked to you, you and team had created two really new interesting things, SuperFetch and ReadyBoost, both adding extra capability for processing, et cetera, and dealing with memory.
Yes. So those are there still.
Of course they are, but what's going on with them anyway?
So we like to think of these things as mechanisms and policies. So there's a set of mechanisms that were built into Vista and a set of policies that govern those, how those mechanisms worked. Mm. We have the same kinds of mechanisms enhanced a bit in 7. So let's take ReadyBoost as an example. Mm. Instead of limiting itself to a single USB stick or a single SSD that might be your extra memory cache, it can accommodate multiple of them now. Nice. Instead of being limited to a size of 4 gigabytes, it can be hundreds of gigabytes in size. So those mechanisms just provide better capabilities now in 7 than before. There's also some efficiency improvements that went into that as well, and a better unification between the SuperFetch core mechanisms and the ReadyBoost core mechanisms. But I think the big wins are actually on the policy side. So Vista was a version 1 set of algorithms that dealt with things like, is the user present, not present, what should we do in those conditions, battery, not battery, pages used over time from different apps, usage history, etc. All of that information, those were version one algorithms. You could expect that over the years of getting data back from how Vista was performing and getting feedback from people and looking at how the applications were using the system, we'd be better at that and have a different set of algorithms. And I actually think that those algorithms are like the efficiency improvements that we put into the system, a big part of why people think Windows 7 performs better.
Absolutely. Let me ask you, just out of curiosity, one of the really fundamental kind of amazing things that happened from an engineering perspective at the lowest level of the system was the work done by Arun, Kishan, and the removal of the global dispatcher lock in the kernel, managing threads.
Yeah.
Had that help you at all in your coding?
Absolutely. So let's give some credit to that effort. There was a I think almost a quest-like feeling to that. I mean, there's a set of things that happened in our system over the last number of decades that involved acquiring a lock, doing some work, and releasing that lock. The ability to get away from needing to acquire that lock is a huge thing for us. It really opened the door for scaling to new heights. Now, there are some trade-offs that go along with that, but let's talk about scaling to new heights.
Sure.
We had big iron servers running in our lab, running benchmarks where once you got above a certain number of processors, let's say 128, there was pretty much no way you could be running without one of those processors holding that key lock at any given time. So at every point in time, that dispatcher lock was held by some processor, 100% hold time somewhere. Pretty bad experiences happen at that. It governs how fast your system essentially can go from a scaling standpoint, or how far it can go from a scaling standpoint. Arun's breaking up of that lock and going with a much more granular scheme actually changes the game for us. Now we can drive very, very high CPU utilization across hundreds of cores and feel very good about our scaling in that regard. We were concerned about compatibility, though. I mean, would this scheduling change then leave us with a major problem with some apps essentially, you know, running differently because the behavior of the way threads are scheduled were going to be a problem. The fact that we were able to pull off the engineering and not have that compatibility issue was a big win for us. Sure. As I mentioned earlier, I kind of own the app compat mission too, so keeping apps running well matters. So performance and compatibility could have been at odds there, but we were fortunate to be able to eat our cake and have it too.
Absolutely. So just real quickly, I mean, the vision of when you guys set out for Windows 7, right, as you mentioned earlier, from an engineer's perspective, I'm hearing that it was efficiency, and compatibility.
Scalability. Reliability.
Perfect.
All those kinds of things. And there was simplicity as well, and people having a pleasing experience using it, and productivity enhancements, et cetera. A lot of goals, actually, I think, span the whole Windows 7 team. Mm-hmm. But some of them kind of like resonated more with some teams like mine, and so that's why I kind of look at the efficiency one, and being able to preserve compatibility while improving performance is a big one.
And one of the things that your team does, and we've actually gone and talked to several of the members of your team, is essentially, at least in my opinion, Windows seems to be a little smarter. And what I mean by that, and how it deals with faults, how it deals with exceptions, how it deals with problems, and basically bubbling up that problems happen to a user in a way that actually is useful, right? More useful than in the past, I would argue. So we've talked about the fault-tolerant heap, which in some cases just does things automatically.
Yeah, that's the best solutions. The ones where the user doesn't know anything was wrong and it fixed itself on its own.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those are the best ones.
And then, of course, with the troubleshooting and diagnostics, you guys have made it a lot easier for people to understand what's wrong and then for the Windows to go out and get a solution.
So the online troubleshooter is actually a game changer for us in many ways. Mm-hmm. When we look forward, we think people will use their systems differently because of its presence. Still too early to know if that's the case, but here's how we hope the scenario unfolds. Mm-hmm. Today, we're Microsoft, and we ship an operating system, and then users make choices to change that. They add new software, they configure it in different ways, etc. And every once in a while, a pattern will develop where similar thinking people change their PC configurations in similar ways, and we'll start noticing through our telemetry system that there are people out there having problems, and it's because they're doing these things. And the right solution isn't always that obvious from a Microsoft standpoint, but if we have a conversation with the user about it, it can be obvious. Mm-hmm. So we've built this troubleshooting mechanism where we might say, for instance, there's three things that the user should think about in order to improve their situation. we can't automatically make one of those three things. One of them might be change the way something they installed is configured. Another might be you might want to consider removing it. These are difficult things for us to do back here at Microsoft. But if the user goes to the Action Center and says, I'm having a performance problem, or I'm having this particular problem, they've started a conversation with our online troubleshooters at that point. Mm-hmm. And that's our opportunity to have that conversation. We can then say, hey, here's what we've noticed that's going funny on your machine. We would recommend the following choices, but you know, ultimately it's your decision. At that point, they're looking at it and they go, ah, I get it. The root causes are identified for me, and I have to make a decision as to which way to fix it. Some things can't be fixed on their own. We do think the best solutions are the ones where we can just automatically fix it and self-heal ourselves.
Yeah.
So if an app starts crashing, we recognize the pattern of crashes, we can get a fix out there automatically without the user having to feel like they had to be involved. But if it's about configuration changes, uninstall an app, for instance, or change what's in your startup group, those are really personal decisions that the user made. It's hard to undo those. Mm-hmm. So we think the conversation through the troubleshooters is the way we're going to do that.
Now, that brings up an interesting point. I mean, we should really pan over here real quickly to this sort of rather amazing architectural diagram of the telemetry system.
Because it's big.
Just because it's big, it kind of looks like the dependency tree in Windows.
In some respects.
not quite that complex. But I'm curious, when you mentioned... I love the notion, personally, of self-healing systems and homeostasis and stuff like that, but we're not quite there.
Right.
But in some sense, if something goes wrong on the system communicates out to some web service. The web service does some computation, sends some information back. The user is still not involved. Theoretically, you could just fix it.
Yes.
I mean, you don't have to let me know that, oh, system's like, there's something wrong with this driver. Goes up. Yes, we know that. Here. Here's the link to the driver. Here's the bits. Here's the package. Install it. User might see a blink or something and keep on going. Is that something that happens, or is it? I mean,
it starts with consent of the user at some point, right?
Sure.
So we use the term opt in. So a user gets the decision or makes the decision to be a part of the consumer experience improvement program. And depending on how they chose to opt in, some are just like, don't ever tell me about this again. Just always do what you think is best. That level of opt-in can provide some relief that other levels wouldn't. Some people prefer to see, some message that there's something. And so they might see in the Action Center that there's a flag that says there's something that you should consider doing.
Sure.
At which point we might have a conversation about what to fix. But let's go with the most common case, because it's the one I think most people kind of recognize. An application crashes on their machine. The user has already decided they're going to share some information with Microsoft, something that's not divulging of privacy information about the crash. And there's a back-end service that sees information from the crash, looks at the signature of it, and then we have a chance to respond to the user, like there's an updated version of the application already available or a new driver already available. You want it installed for you, et cetera. We can have that conversation with them that way. They're still in the loop there, right? Mm. There are ways that they can actually opt in where they just basically just fix things automatically for me. The fault-tolerant heap is kind of an interesting mechanism in its own, because independent of actually talking to the back end and looking at the cloud for information, it actually can make some decisions on its own. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have any extra information. And a lot of those decisions are done completely without the user actually being aware. So we see the repeated crash pattern, it automatically fixes itself. Now, if the user's opted into sharing data, that does go back to the cloud, and then we kind of think of it as, Team Windows. All of the people that are a part of opting in and contributing information, that information comes back into the cloud, and we mine it, we rip it, we shred it, we look for patterns, we bucketize things, and then a solution can come from that. And then that solution can go out to everybody else. And when that solution trickles out to other people, they may never have hit the problem themselves, but now they've basically been inoculated from getting it in the future. So they might have that same version of the app, but for whatever reason they hadn't hit the problem, but then next week they might have. But now this inoculation has happened and they're free from hitting that problem in the first place. And that to us is kind of like the model for many of the other services. But it does require people to want to participate. Mm-hmm. And then that information, like I said, if we can do it in such a clean, simple way, it just makes other people's experiences with their computers better. And that's why we think of it as kind of like a global Team Windows concept. Everybody's contributing to make everybody else's experiences better. The same will be true for performance over time as well. In the performance game right now, we're pushing out fixes and troubleshooters, but it's not quite as cleanly integrated as that particular solution. Over time, it will get there, though.
Sure. So let's talk about performance a little bit specifically, since you mentioned it.
Yes.
What What have you guys done? I mean, in terms of, I mean, you've cleaned up your code, you've understood dependencies, you've removed things, et cetera, et cetera. Done really excellent work in the services world where you're not loading every single service that's on my system by default, which is what you do in Vista. Let's talk a little bit
about
that.
Not everyone.
Not everyone, but like ones that don't need.
Yes, yes. So the breaking down services into their base functionality was a big part of the early thinking in Windows 7 and building new mechanisms. We actually found that when we looked at why some things were running, they simply were lacking, we were lacking some mechanisms in the system to get them running at the right time.
Wow.
So a notion developed that we need to have better trigger starting mechanisms for services. And instead of us actually starting a service for it to listen to a rare event, the rare event is going to be a trigger. Now, we already had some of those, but when we looked, again, holistically across the landscape of services that ran with frequency on customer machines, and then we stepped back and says, what are they waiting to trigger off of? That's when we found that there were gaps in our triggering mechanisms, and we added a whole bunch more. Mm-hmm. And that triggering set of mechanisms that got added now allowed us to lighten the load considerably. So if you're running a system in a certain way, you don't use any of this functionality, you won't pay any of the cost of it. And that was kind of like, you know, one of our big efficiency wins in the 7 time frame. Mm-hmm. And we'll keep doing that over time. You know, I look at it today and there's still a few gaps that we need to fill with new triggers. They're relatively small in nature, but, you know, it's one of those things where people are thinking of new ways to use the system and they're using services for that. We have to think of new mechanisms to make sure that those services can start only when needed and get out of the way as soon as possible, too. Turns out it's not just about what starts. It's also about getting them to stop appropriately after a period of time. And so the coordinated effort across all of Windows, but also our ecosystem partners, is really what has resulted in the big memory reductions and service footprint reductions that you see in the platform today.
Awesome. And that, of course, has impact on boot time and resume time. Because I've noticed resume from hibernation is...
Yeah.
Really fast.
Yeah, both our resume scenarios were, well, so resume was interesting. So we kind of took a person and said, you're now the champion for resume. And your lens onto what is good resume performance and what is bad resume performance is first and foremost telemetry coming back from real users' machines. So before we got to beta, people were walking around with their laptops all around Microsoft running early versions of Windows 7. And every time they opened their lid, a resume trace was essentially sent back to us. And we literally had a person basically scouring every single one of those, looking for all the vulnerabilities, not just looking to reduce what work was done, but looking for problem patterns that could produce problems later. We are a platform, and other things can plug on top of it. And so it's not just that we have to be lean and mean. We have to think about architecturally, is having this platform component operating in this way going to lead to hangs or slowdowns for the customer if somebody adds something to it later? So that really intense focus by an individual for a long period of time on real telemetry traces, not just the lab, produced tremendous wins for us.
Awesome. Well, make sure they get to go on a vacation in Maui, all right?
I believe he's going on vacation next week, actually.
Awesome. Really, really, really good stuff. So let's continue real quick in terms of the engineering. I mean, when Sinofsky came over, clearly there was this new sort of, you know, focus on efficient, effective engineering. Can you talk about what kind of changes for you personally in the Windows 7 timeframe that you may not have had in Windows Vista? I mean, you're a great engineer. I mean, I'm sure you didn't change your personal coding habits and architectural things, but
so
you know what I'm trying to ask.
The challenge of something like Windows is it's thousands of engineers, all of them very good, but if you're not orchestrated in an appropriate way, you can be working on many things that aren't quite the right things. I'm not saying they're the wrong things, but if you look at it from a different perspective, you say, it's really the most important thing for us to know to do. Well, it's what to work on, right? Mm-hmm. And so when Stephen and others came over, they focused heavily on, let's be planful, right? Let's think about things and be deliberate in what we do. That actually fits very nicely with things that we've talked about for many years, which is, You need to be really careful to decide what to work on. That's the most important thing we do, deciding what to work on. Mm-hmm. And being planful, being deliberate is essentially that. And so when thousands of engineers start being planful and deliberate, and things about quality and performance and compatibility are messaged clearly from senior leaders, then that's going to factor into everybody's thoughts. And that actually then produced a very interesting team dynamic that allowed us to focus really kind of laser-like on some areas and say, we're going to have people going after this. That is one of the important things. It's a what that we care about, and let's make sure everybody's got the time, energy, and effort to go nail it. And so, you know, it was really a nice, pleasant change in many regards, to have that global team kind of being able to be focused in a laser-like way on some things.
Absolutely. Now, when you're focused in a laser-like way on some things, did you find that there was perhaps a lack of the ability to innovate or the want, like to come up with new features, right? Because, I mean, one of the things you got credit, Vista deserves credit, is that when you guys created that, you added an incredible number of features, and you really kind of had this big dream, right? Some of them were a little questionable, like WinFS. I mean, no one really thought that could actually work, but you tried. So in the Win7 time frame, being so organized and sort of efficient, do you find that there was some, and this is just a really random question, it just came up, which is what we do on Channel 9. Did you find that it kind of inhibited crazy ideas?
I don't think it inhibited crazy ideas. I personally didn't find it to be inhibiting in any way. I look at it from a standpoint of, you know, we're gonna have a schedule that people are gonna believe in. Mm-hmm. In order for us to do that, we're gonna need to be able to think carefully about the set of things we're gonna do and the set of things we're not gonna do. Mm-hmm. And once you decide some things aren't gonna be done, that allows you to essentially focus on some things that you need to do. And then you look at the time that you have to do and you say, I'm going to be innovative within that time window. It turns out there's plenty of time to be innovative
Sure. If
you don't basically spread yourself too thin across too many different areas. So again, the focusing aspect of stuff is actually a liberating thing, not just because it, you know, lets your mind focus on that one thing, but it actually allows you to innovate within a space very clearly and cleanly. And I think so in many regards, it's not that we had to sacrifice innovation. We were able to focus our innovation.
Absolutely. And certainly, you know, a lot of innovations did happen at many levels.
Yeah, I think if you went and talked to customers, you talked to our partners and said, look, would you rather them do a bunch of things that spread very thinly across the large landscape, right, some of which are little bits of innovations here or there, or would you rather have a few bang-for-the-buck type innovations that really are nailed end-to-end? And I think they would largely say, I'll give us the big bang-for-the-buck in innovations that are nailed end-to-end.
Absolutely. So speaking of customers, I mean, what kind of feedback are you getting from, you know, our ISVs and whatnot that I know you work with and communicate with? Are they really solidly stoked on this? Or
they are. So it's different feedback this time than we've gotten in the past. Our ability to tell people the time periods when we're going to have certain things and the quality they can expect at that point, you know, initially was met with some skepticism. But then when we started delivering that way, their perspective changed, and they said, well, you know, that's actually above the quality level we anticipated, and right when you said it would be there. That allows them to plan better, allows them to think differently about how they're going to get their solutions working end-to-end. And so the feedback's been very positive on that, because all of a sudden there was predictability. People like predictability. When you're running a business and you're trying to figure out what your engineers are going to do quarter to quarter, whether you're at Microsoft or somewhere else, predictability of things is very important, especially when it's in your supply chain, essentially. We have to supply them bits so that they can prepare their bits or their hardware or whatever it is in order to get done. So the feedback's been very positive in that regard, mostly surprise positive. And that, I think, is now going to be something they expect, which is a good challenge for us. Mm-hmm. Their expectations are now raised, and so we're going to expect a different level of feedback going forward. But, you know, we've heard all sorts of people say things like, hey, you should just ship it now, months ago. Mm-hmm. Well, we had not met our own internal quality criteria for that. We weren't ready to ship yet, so we're not going to, you know, rush something out the door just because we've heard positive praise that way. Yeah. But, you know, going forward, though, I think that we've raised the bar for ourselves. We now have to achieve that bar because our partners are expecting more from us, and I think that's a good thing too.
Absolutely. And one of the most incredible things I've found so far about Windows 7 is the Windows 7 kernel is slightly larger than the Vista kernel.
There's more features in it, yeah.
Exactly.
But it's more efficient.
I'm running it on a 512 megabyte outdated machine, the Lifebook Pro by Fujitsu. It runs, which is amazing.
So we used to
throw that out there, man.
Well, we used to walk around with a chart, and I'm going to try and... It was a diagram of a scale, right? Two sides of the scale, right? Mm-hmm. Heavy, whatever. And we used to talk a lot about how the cost of the new essentially has to be paid for by improvements in the old. So when you look at Windows 7, there are more features. There are more new things in Windows 7. It does more things in different ways than any previous Windows. So it's a superset of our previous efforts. Okay. And yet it's more efficient in many ways than pretty much anything else we've shipped. So when we look at that, we kind of go, well, that's a good thing. And it's all basically because the cost of the new was offset not just by an equal amount, but by a larger number of improvements. And so that's kind of a good thing, though, that scale model. It's something to keep in mind. And again, I think we've just raised the bar on ourselves. This is something we'd like to repeat. So, mm-hmm. you know, how are we going to continue to repeat on this? Well,
I think you probably will.
Yeah. But yeah, you can expect the bits, if you count them, to be greater in subsequent offerings, but the overall efficiency to be better. I think we've got this understood now.
That's amazing. Excellent. Well, hey, it's always great to talk to you.
My pleasure.
And I think we've covered a lot. I mean, power. The last interview I had with the troubleshooting and diagnostics, or actually perf track people, trying to get this all. It's all interrelated.
Yes, it is.
One of the things that we did talk about was power consumption.
Yeah.
I know that Windows 7 really does handle power better. It goes into lower mode. It does less things. It does more things in the background than it needs to, or it stops things when they really aren't necessary. That's all sort of, again, the makings of a more intelligent operating system, which is the direction that seems to be going.
Yeah. So go back to mechanisms and policies, right? Mm-hmm. So our hardware today is better from a power management standpoint than hardware the day before. Mm-hmm. So there's a set of mechanisms that we can use. The operating system knows how to use those mechanisms, and it does use those mechanisms. The question is, how does it use them? So the mechanisms are there. The policies to use them have to improve, too. So we're using better mechanisms from our hardware providers. That's good. Our policies have advanced as well. You can simplify it to some extent and say, to get idle and stay idle. Right? If we're not moving bits around, if we're not waking up threads, if we're not scheduling things, if we're not hitting the disk, you know, that activity, or that idleness is going to produce power savings. And so big, big focus on that. Get idle, stay idle. Anytime you see something happening, question why it needs to happen then. We're on battery. For goodness sake, couldn't we do that at some better, more appropriate time? So controlling when and how things run was a big part of the efficiency improvements as well. Turns out if you don't run stuff a lot, you can be lean and mean in many ways, not just from memory use, not just from disk I.O., and not just from polluting cache lines in the processor. I mean, it's really kind of a win everywhere. So the get idle, stay idle mantra that drove a lot of the battery improvements and power efficiency improvements actually benefited elsewhere, or benefited other parts of the system as well.
Absolutely. One last question, because we can never end when we think we're going to end. I love that about doing this job. You mentioned ManyCore and the whole ManyCore craze that's going on. There's actually a physical problem. Like, if you have 1,000 cores, let's say, hypothetical, there's going to be a cache problem.
Yes.
To get to those cores.
Yes.
So that problem has to be figured out. And that's not our problem. That's a hardware problem. But it's an interesting problem.
It's our problem, too. I mean, there's a partitioning that saves some workloads, right? If you can safely segment things and partition so that there's not much sharing and interaction, you can exploit the parallelism on the processors to a pretty high degree. Mm-hmm. The problem is that a lot of software developers and even operating system code itself expects to communicate with other things that are around it. Mm-hmm. And those communications, of course, mean, well, I've got relationships that I've somehow got to manage. Data's got to move from one part of the processor to another, pollute one cache line here, there, mm-hmm. somewhere else. And so those things become a challenge from a partitioning standpoint. Mm-hmm. So I think it is not just a hardware problem, it's a software problem as well. Mm-hmm. It's something we're staring at very carefully. there are no magic bullets just yet, right? It's hard to write highly parallel, highly optimized code. That's kind of true. We talk about it as, you know, kind of an Einstein-class programmer.
But Landy Wang has no problem doing it, right?
Einstein-class programmers can write highly parallel code and do so with efficiency. Yeah. Arun doesn't have problems with that either. Yeah. But you know, when you think about, you know, the types of applications that run on the Windows platform, there are many, many, many types of applications. Some of them are old, and we'd like them to run well on newer hardware. So they weren't written for a parallel world, but we'd still like to run them well. And then there are going to be some new ones as well. And when we think about how we want people to write new parallel applications, we've got to do some work at the interface level of the operating system and with our runtimes to make that easier for them, because it is still too hard. So we've got some work to do to help them.
Absolutely.
Quite a bit, actually.
Cool. Yeah. All right. Well, hey, we'll talk to you again.
Okay.
Maybe around whatever the next version of Windows is, we'll come and visit you.
All right.
And maybe
thanks.
Again during
Always
the space.
Always my pleasure, Charles.
It's great to see you again.
Good to see you, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.